I didn't hear the tones, but I guess I'm in there. I used to work for Hazeldine Corporation, which doesn't exist anymore, in test engineering. And we used to pull a lot of tricks like this that the young engineers right out of college had never learned in school, over.
Yep. And I used to know this. I'm a little bit disappointed with RIW tonight. Good thing you came along and straightened me out. I was really viewing a single sideband transmitter as if it was an amplitude modulated AM transmitter. Single sideband with a single tone only gives you a steady carrier output. And there's something that's a little hard to believe. A single tone going into a microphone of a sideband transmitter, without a doubt, single tone does go through zero amplitude periodically. It goes through a positive peak, zero, negative peak, zero, and so on. It goes through zero amplitude periodically, the audio of that tone, one single tone. Common sense would lead you to believe that in the AM transmitter, when the audio goes through zero, the carrier output goes to something very low, or but at some given level. A sideband transmitter doesn't behave that way. The sideband transmitter looks at that tone and says, hey, I'm going to put out a steady carrier. And only if two individual carriers created by two individual tones are beating against each other, then you get what looks like amplitude modulation, this butterfly on the output. It's a good thing you straightened me out on this one, Ed. I was leading John and his writer astray. So there's more to it than first meets the eye. Imagine there are sections of the sideband. There are sections of the sideband handbook, or the single sideband section of the radio amateur's handbook, and other books. I can't think of the name of it. Bruni? Papenfuss. I think it was Papenfuss. Wrote one of the original McGraw-Hill books on the subject of single sideband modulation. And so it's going to take a little bit more study to understand what's happening. But I'm slowly concluding, John, that when it comes to sideband monitoring, as long as the writer is willing to use two separate tones, he can definitely get a beautiful butterfly display on his oscilloscope. Hope I'm going to be able to hear you. You might have to come through the UHF link, John. KC2 WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yes, I'm on the UHF link now. Okay, but this writer is talking about using this on 2-meter FM. So that's his issue. I assume what he wants to do is he wants to be able to speak into the mic and watch the waveform dance around up there. And he wanted to do it externally. I don't think he's going to have much success with that.
The nice thing about FM, which is very, very different than AM and sideband, is that the receiver can tolerate a tremendous amount of overload. In other words, you can have a receiver in the shack with you that's connected to nothing and it's just got a leakage through the cabinet that is allowing the signal to get in. Or you put a small little piece of wire at the end of its UHF connector, if it's not picking up enough, while you're transmitting through your FM transmitter into the antenna, and all the leads are properly shielded, whatever, in the shack with you, there's going to be a tremendous amount of signal that the FM second receiver will pick up. And if you now take that second receiver, plug it through a set of earphones that are on your head, or plug it into a tape recorder, so to speak, the modern-day equivalent of a tape recorder, record that audio and then play it back, you will know the degree of your linearity, the quality of your audio, and whatever. A second FM receiver in the shack with you gives you 90% or 95% of the performance you want. You try doing that with a single sideband transmitter, and the overload will create all kinds of distortion.
Go ahead, Dick. Where are you? Are you with John?
Amplitude modulation on a, in other words, FM modulation into a receiver that's being overloaded.
Turnpike between Lakeville and Newhead Park in front of Modell.
You guys are coming over a link you may not want to.
By the deli we spoke of earlier today.
Are you guys hearing me? K2YO. A sideband, an amplitude modulated transmitter, sideband or AM, you cannot operate with the receiver in the same shack and get linearity. With FM, you can. So rather than go through the process of building a discriminator to go into the oscilloscope, simply taking a second FM receiver tuned to the same frequency you're transmitting to, plug that audio output into the oscilloscope if you like, or listen to it with earphones or with a tape recorder. So you can monitor your own FM. And with a receiver in the shack with you, and the overload almost creates no grief. I wonder if you've ever done that, Joan. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely, Dick. That's my easiest way of doing it. And I can hear anything I want to hear with the second receiver. And I've also recorded it, and I've watched it on my monitors, and that's my best way of doing it. Rather than try to work with the transmitter that I'm transmitting on. It didn't make any sense to me to even put that kind of effort in there. Yeah, but what you're saying is right. No matter what, I think he's going to have to try some different things and maybe do some more reading, because what he's trying to do, I don't believe is practical.
Now, you said what you think he's trying to do may not be practical. What do you believe he's trying to do, John? Go ahead.
Basically, I think what he wants to see is his voice modulating the carrier on an oscilloscope as he's speaking. I guess we all wanted to do that at one time, whether it be AM or FM. But I think he definitely has no equipment. He just acquired an oscilloscope, and that's what he wants to do with it. And it's I think it's the model number he gave me here. I think it's good to 20 megahertz. That's a pretty decent scope.
And with a 20 megacycle rated scope, 80, 40, and 20 meters will come through very nicely. Also, even though an oscilloscope is only rated to 20 megacycles, if the signal you're plugging in is strong enough, although you'll get a little bit less response, I guarantee the 15 meter band at 21 megacycles will come through that scope quite well. I believe the 10 meter band will come through that scope quite well. I will admit that when you start going up as high as the 6-meter band, 50 megacycles, on a 20-megacycle scope, although you'll get a deflection on the screen from the vertical deflection circuitry of the scope, because that deflection is falling off so fast in gain, the 20 megs at the beginning of the roll-off, by the time you get up to 50 megs, you've got a whole lot of roll-off. Let me drop. Because now you're getting so much roll-off, you have to increase the amplitude of what you're sending to the oscilloscope a whole lot, or turn up the gain, so to speak. And as such, one of the earlier amplification stages might saturate, and therefore you'll get a distorted waveform. So I have done something like taking a 20 megacycle scope, putting a whopping big signal into it, and making it run at 50 megacycles of signal, and displaying it on the screen. But sometimes the display on the screen starts getting nonlinear because you're overloading one of the stages, because the final section that's driving the vertical deflection plates of the cathode ray tube are starting to saturate. So I'm pretty sure he'll have no trouble displaying 15 meters, and I think there's a good chance he can display 10 meters with that 20 megacycle scope. The frequency rating of the scope is not a hard and fast rule. It doesn't suddenly catch on fire if you go a megacycle above that, in my opinion, John. But FM, it's pretty easy to monitor your FM, but to display it on an oscilloscope, to display FM on an oscilloscope, you can build a discriminator and take the audio output of the discriminator and display it, but that's almost identical to the audio output of a second receiver. So, displaying FM on an oscilloscope has limited benefit from my point of view. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Well, there we're in agreement, absolutely. It's like bells and whistles. You're right about the oscilloscopes. If it's a 20 megahertz scope, you can push it to 35. But what you'll notice happens first is the pickoff of the trigger starts to react in funny ways and very bad stability. And that tells you right there your vertical amplifiers are reaching their limit. So after that, it's really not accurate, so yeah, you'll see a dancing wave, but I don't see how that would be any use. But I guess he wants to play, and that's what the sport's all about. Back to you, Dick.
Let me do a quick test. I'm not sure of whether or not we're going to be able to. WS2N, Paul, if you're available, use the, give us a brief transmission on 146.2585. Over to you, Paul, if you're available. WS2N, K2RIW.
Standby, morning, a couple one.
Okay, you're coming through reasonably well right now. Give us a brief transmission. Go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, this is WS. Dick, well, you got a minute. Did you?
What did you say, John, if I got a minute?
Microscope yet?
Oh, yes. Beautiful microscope. That's a, I'm going to call it a macro lens. That's the good news. Every computer in my house is a Linux type. My son brought over his laptop, which does have a Microsoft emulator in it, and he was able to make it work. But because all of my computing hardware in the house is Linux based, I think the output of the macro camera is not properly formatted for Linux. That's what my son believed, but maybe he's wrong, and maybe you know more about that. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
I know, Dick. On the regular Windows. Pretty soon you'll probably latch on.
So I think you're saying pretty soon I'll latch on to a real computer. a Microsoft computer instead of all these Linux stuff. My son, who does a lot of networking, just loves Linux, and he thinks he doesn't like Microsoft, but from time to time he's got to use it, let's face it. So you don't know of a way of making that beautiful macro camera compatible with a Linux-based system. Is that true, John? KQWG? K2RIW?
No, Dick, I don't have a clue. But maybe you can have a phone call. You can still shot it. You can do over millions of people. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I agree with you. A big kick using it. I think it's a high probability you can come through on the 2585 at this time, John. Do you have a... wait a minute. Let's see now. I wonder which input you were using, Paul, when you just made your attempt. WS2N, were you using the Eastern input or the Western input? Over to you, Paul. I think at this time you'd be better off using the Western input. Give me a quick transmission into the Western input, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good.
Make the transmission a little bit longer, John.
Okay, very good. This is West Wind. We put it in here. Okay.
Unfortunately, only medium. How late can you stay up tonight, Paul? Go ahead.
I'll be up until the cows come home.
Okay. Are you really retired? You don't have to go to work tomorrow like I do? How about you, Paul?
QSM. Check QRZ.
Fantastic. I didn't know you were old enough to retire. How long ago did you really retire, Paul?
Semi-retired. That was good.
Okay. So there are real retired people. I mean, in theory, I retired in 2000. But I've worked essentially every day ever since. And I think I've got to do that for economic reasons. Okay. We're going to wait a little bit longer, Paul. It's going to be around longer. Do you have a third one, John? KC2WGB? K2RIW?
No, Dick. That was it. Just the two. But if you got a second, I'll give you some more information.
Go ahead with the more information.
In the mail, you're going to get a little fitting. I don't know if you've ever seen a fitting like this. It's a type of BNC connector. It's a very special fitting which we install probably 1,000 of these things. Wait till you see this device. Very nice. And I use this device developing a CAN antenna for 2 gigahertz and 4 gigahertz. When you see that, you're going to see how simple it makes building a CAN antenna.
Now, you called it a BNC connector or a BNC-like connector. Is it approximately that size? And you may know that there's a high-voltage version of a BNC connector, which has a longer piece of Teflon and a longer center conductor, and it's called the MHV, which I guess stands for maximum high voltage or something like that. So is this thing about the BNC diameter? And it's a bayonet, I think you're saying it's a bayonet light connector. Is it some other diameter? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, it's exactly that. It's a BNC connector, but it's not the high voltage one. It's a regular BNC. But on the opposite end, it has a plug-in device, a jack, where you plug in a cable that's very similar to the RG-174, and a little different, but it's a 50-ohm cable. And it is so well made, and you can plug in different lengths of tips to make antennas any length you want. You can coil them, you can do what you want, but you don't have to reach into the can and do any soldering. You just plug in a new length. It works beautifully.
Sounds awful, a lot of fun. Where did you find that connector, John?
We had to install those on a job that took almost 2 hours, and I had a handful of them done. Tektronix has them on some of their, especially their high potential stuff. It makes it very convenient to make these connections. And also the cross connection. When you see it, it's real. I don't know if you've ever seen one that, or what I'm describing, I can't even describe it properly. The ferrule that crimps onto the little coax, the 174, is a little bit of a sticking out of it. So it winds up being almost like an RCA type plug that goes in, except it's the reciprocal view of the RCA. And perfect contact, it's all gold. You'll have a ball just looking at how that thing is made. It's made very well.
Sounds good. There are connectors and there are... And that the whole science of connectors is something else. When it comes to that... When it comes to the macro camera, I feel a little bit guilty about the fact that I'm not going to be using it as much as I would like until I... Until my son finally establishes a Microsoft-based computer in our house. We've all got Linux. Everything in our house is Linux. I feel a little bit guilty because, from my point of view, that's a fairly expensive item you know. I mean, till now, but I have sent back and forth with only medium value. How are you getting into the expensive stuff? And my conscience is beginning to bother me a little bit, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Don't worry about it. I have quite a few of them. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Also, I'm sure they got a USB port at work.
Yeah, that's a good point. Got it. Got it. They do have USB ports that work. Let's see if I can get through by the other input. I'm getting around S6 at my QTH right now. I'm going to try the other input. Hello, 1-2. A2. West now has a full 100 watts output. I've looked at some of West's material. The sprites are kind of beautiful. The Geissler tubes are kind of beautiful. And that very simple the motor that consists of a screw and a spun by the piece here that brings power to it. That's kind of cute. Let's see how we can get through the to enter a MRIW.
Enter. 1, 2, 3.
KC2WRIW.
transmitting UH and UHF and receiving on the 2.5. Try it again, Dick.
T2LIW, Chester. Okay. Looks like I've got a way I can get through. And so you do it on the UHF, I guess. Very good. I guess my main question, John, was how did you end up with so many of those cameras? Did you decide that it's such a valuable thing you decided to buy a lot of them? Was there a group deal or somebody else can buy the dozen? And it looks to me like $150 worth of hardware at least. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Oh, no, Dick. It was like $15, I think. Something like that. That's why I bought four of them. And they all worked well. So, and that's with the software and all. You can't beat it. Direct from China.
That is amazing. Oh, amazing. Wow. Huh. That's hard to believe. Huh. That's a lot of quality for the money. It reminds me of the, there's a particular machine store I can go to that sells machine tools out in, is it Ronkonkoma? Yes, in the Ronkonkoma area, where these are Chinese-made equivalent of a Dremel tool, drill motor, quite a few things. A complete Dremel tool set with zillions of attachments and drills and all kinds of things. The whole darn kit is $20. And it's a variable speed, high-speed Dremel tool in a very nice plastic carrying package. So you probably already have a Dremel tool. Wow. Where did you find those? And do you believe they're brand new? I'm amazed they can build that for that price. Do you believe those are brand new, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick. Bought them from China. Brand new, in the box. All wrapped and everything. Beautiful. And very well packaged, too. And that was with shipping and everything. So it was, like $80-something dollars for all four of them shipped direct from China. And I found that on the internet.
Be gone, Dick. Harbor Freight.
I think, no, he says Harbor, not Harbor Freight. We're hearing you beautifully now through the Eastern Input poll. I don't think that was Harbor Freight. You bought them, what was the actual dealer you bought them from, John? Go ahead.
I think Paul was asking you if your purchase was from Harbor Freight, your Dremel tool. I don't know, something like Wu Tang Ping or something from China. I could look it up if you're interested.
I'm not necessarily required. Let's see if I'm coming through. Yes, I am. No, the Dremel tool that I bought was not Harbor Freight, Paul. It was, I can't think of the name of the store. It's in Ronkonkoma. Is it Hawkins Avenue? It could be Hawkins Avenue or whatever it's called on the north side. Gee, I wish I could remember the name of the street. There's a main street that goes down to, it's an expressway exit that goes down to Holbrook. And if you take that street north and go across Jericho, and I think I crossed Jericho, and there's a shopping center on the western side. After you cross Jericho, you go across the street, and I'll get you the name of the store. They don't always have them. They run out of them periodically, but boy, they got some very nice tools for inexpensive prices. I think I'm hearing you very well for the Eastern Input. Give it a transmission, Paul. That's US2N, K2LIW.
Real good. Okay, yeah, Harbor Freight just opened. Yeah, well, I'm talking about, you know, it's officially in Santa Reach, which is like the next town over. But I thought maybe you went there because they just opened, maybe a month or so ago. And they're pretty good. They have all the stuff that's dirt cheap. Pretty quality, you know, from what I see, high quality. Got a heat gun there and a few other things, but very good.
Okay, you're coming through so beautifully right now, Paul. Why don't you give us a space report? WS2N? What's NASA doing this week, K2LIW? And by the way, you may have heard, they finally think they resolved the super speed of the neutrinos. And at first I was thinking that it couldn't possibly be a delay of a poor connector, because if the detection of the neutrinos was going through a connector and being delayed, that would have made them appear late. Well, we now know pretty well that their clocks are very well synchronized. However, I think there's a comparator circuit in their network which compares when the arrival pulse from the neutrino occurs and compares it to the clock pulses coming from their reference oscillator. And I'm guessing that the clock pulses from the reference oscillator going through a defective connector were arriving late. So if your clock pulses are arriving late compared to the pulses of the neutrino detection, it will make the neutrino detection look like it came there too soon. So I think they finally resolved it. The person who is running the experiment has resigned his position. I'm sorry that had to happen, because he told everybody, this is what we measured, please check it out, I know it doesn't seem right, and why should he be embarrassed about the fact that there was a mistake that did get discovered? And at the time he made the announcement saying, I don't believe it, but help me out on this one. A lot of people made lots of suggestions, a lot of tests were run, and they eventually discovered it. I don't think he should have to resign over that one. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I give him a promotion. More stuff is learned from mistakes. That's the way I look at it. Very good, Dick. Space program. At the end of this month now, the 30th of April, they're going to have a commercial spacecraft dock with the International Space Station. This was supposed to happen in February, but it's been delayed. It's called the Dragon. I've talked about it before. Presently, it's going to be bringing up cargo. Some years down the road, they have plans of sending up to seven astronauts in this thing. So to give you an idea, it's big enough to take the whole Soyuz spacecraft and put it inside. So it's a big space vehicle that SpaceX, private corporation, is building, and they'll be sending up to close to 6 tons of material to the ISS. I'm looking forward to that. Should be interesting. They just had a docking at the end of a few days ago, last week, when we dropped with the ATV vehicle, the automatic transit vehicle built by the European Space Agency. Especially Italy is very involved with this project, and this was at least over 7 tons of this is the heaviest cargo vehicle that they have now going up there, and it's huge. It's like about 35 feet long, about 15 feet in diameter. It was launched from French Guiana, South America, on an Ariane 5 heavy lift vehicle. It's so big you could take a double decker bus and put it inside, to give you an idea. Let me drop it. So with that docking, they're going to spend many, many weeks unloading this stuff. So you've got the Dragon going up there at the end of the month. You've got the ATV, those vehicles going up on a regular basis. You've got the Progress ships still continuing to supply the space station, as well as the Japanese, not to mention all the science equipment that has to go up and then back down again. Now, the ATV is not going to be able to be returned like the Dragon. The Dragon will come back when we drop. That will come back and be actually a reusable ATV. Will be deorbited into the Pacific, similar to the Progress spacecraft. So that's an ongoing thing until we have our own governmental NASA program, which is probably, I think, the first launch of the SLS, the Space Launch System. That'll be the one that's the equivalent, actually bigger than the whole Saturn V system. That's a 2017 launch time frame, and then that will eventually carry Orion spacecraft on top when we drop it. And with that, we'll have NASA manned program, once again, probably maybe 2018 or 2019 is my guess. But in the meantime, they'll have these private corporations doing the work for our country. And that's the way it is. I didn't get a chance to see the show. I recorded it on 60 Minutes. It sounds like you saw it already, Dick, but I will definitely watch that tomorrow when I get a chance. Something I want to mention, we talked about the WS2N space portion of the TechNet. We talked about resupplying, recharging oxygen, you know, during an EVA. And, it's been done. I knew they had the manifold system in the cargo bay of, it's actually, in the cargo bay, they have an airlock system. And in the airlock system, they have this manifold set up where they're able to recharge the oxygen into the spacesuits during the EVA. They don't have to come inside, depressurize, take helmets off, or anything like that. They actually can do it, and they have done it. That one particular case, the last mission to save the Hubble, STS-126, Massimino, he's from New York, actually. He ran out of, he's running out of oxygen. Let me drop it. They wind up sometimes one guy will use up more oxygen than the other EVA spacewalker. In his case, that was happening. They got down to around 6 hours, and NASA gave him the okay to do exactly that. Came into the back into the cargo bay, right into the airlock, and recharged to go out for a couple more hours. It turned out to be one of the longest space walks ever, until eventually they did the same thing on the space station, changing out one of the ammonia pumps. They ran 8.5 hours or something like that. And they have a similar setup in the Quest Lab. The Quest Lab is a gigantic airlock system for the spacewalk for the United States portion of the ISS. They did make the capability, let me drop it. They did make the capability of allowing the all-land spacesuits to be deployed from that. They have, you could either have the fittings, the same fittings and things like that for the all-land spacesuits, which are Russian, and the American ones. They have different threads, different everything, different connections. Where on the Peerless side, that's the Russian EVA deployment area. You can't do that. You can only send out the Russian EVA all-in spacesuits. There's a big difference, the spacesuits that the Americans use. You have the bottom part, then you have the torso part, which attaches to it with the big rings and all. The Russians are different. It's one big suit. And they open up the back, and they climb in. They actually climb in. There's no separation in the suit itself. And of course, different fittings for everything. So that's the deal on the EVAs. I know we talked about that last week, so I researched that a little bit there. They also had, you might remember the MMUs in the early 1980s. Actually, they ran three flights with these things in 1984, manned maneuvering units. They were actually independent spacecraft that the astronauts would put themselves in. They'd go out into the cargo bay and bolt themselves into this thing, and then it would fly off and had all kinds of nitrogen jets all over it, and they'd be able to fly off completely untethered from the shuttle, go out, grab a satellite, bring it back, whatever they were doing. And these things had nitrogen-charged systems. You could fly around and fly these jets for around 4 hours at a time, and they had a recharge on that in the cargo bay. We drop it. They come into the cargo bay, and they did do this, and they attached to a manifold system there, and they were able to recharge the nitrogen portion. That's what they use for maneuvering in space. So there you go, Dick. A couple of topics. I'll turn it back to you. I don't want to talk about it. I can go on. We have a... they're looking about... down in Chile at all these different planets going around these M-style suns. You know, we have G's and M's. Well, they found out there's plenty of M's. And they're like red dwarfs. And every one of them probably has planets. And the possibility of Goldilocks planets are now multiplying exponentially. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Good news, the fact that the Goldilocks planets are being discovered. And I kind of thought that once they had the right kind of sensitivity of the exoplanet detection systems, that they would discover that there are, that the kind of planets that the Earth is not that rare. I kind of expected that. Yes, you're right that for 60 Minutes tonight, the lead article on 60 Minutes was about the Kennedy Space Center and the cancellation of the shuttle, the cancellation of Constellation, which was going to be the replacement for the space shuttle, which they're saying the Constellation became Cancellation. People were making a joke, but these guys that they interviewed were getting a very emotional response about the fact that, I forget the number now, either 5,000 or 9,000 employees got laid off from NASA because of the cancellation of the space shuttle and the non-continuation of the Constellation. So portions of the towns around the Kennedy Space Center are becoming a ghost town, is the impression you're getting. It's a very sad story. I think they said that the unemployment rate there is quite a bit higher than the rest of the nation. I forget the number, 12%, 14%, something like this. Lots and lots of houses are being foreclosed, and a number of people are just leaving the key in the door and abandoning their house, just walking away from it and going to some other place. And let me drop. The promise that Obama made when he visited NASA, when he was running for, when he was campaigning, was that he wants to make sure that they are being sustained so that the skill set that they have doesn't get lost. Right now, because of the cancellation of those two programs, the people are scattering, the skill set is being lost, and the residents are concluding that he didn't come through with his promise. I think there's more to the story. I believe the lack of funding from Congress was a partial explanation for what has taken place here. Now, let me ask you one other quick question, Paul, and that is, when an astronaut comes back into an airlock to recharge his spacesuit, the spacesuit, when originally charged, is good for something like 6, maybe 7 hours before you start using the emergency section of it. I get the impression from what you said that when they do a recharge while the man is in the suit, that you're not putting back full capacity. He has something like another 2 hours worth. Is that true? That's question number one. And the man maneuvering unit, they're doing it with compressed nitrogen, I think you said. That sounds kind of fun. Be careful. If that gets a stuck valve, and you go up at a high velocity off in some particular direction, rescuing you as an astronaut as you start separating from the space station, I think could get really dicey. So you got to be awful careful that you got some kind of a manual override on that thing just to make sure it doesn't get a stuck valve and blast you off in some crazy direction. I wonder if there's a safety for that somehow. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
So they don't use them anymore. It was 1984. They ran them on three flights during that year, and every flight you had two EVA astronauts doing it. So that, you know, each one had their own MMU, and if one got in trouble, the other one would be able to bring them back. They felt the same way. I mean, this was eventually dropped. They learned a lot from it. They learned that, you know, to controls on the air. You know, control the nitrogen and, you know, how to maneuver and all. So what they do, you know, the astronauts have, you know, it looks like a small backpack that they have, but essentially it's a very small MMU. It's meant for if they make a big mistake, if they disconnect a tether, something goes wrong and they go floating off, they can get back. They do have that on today's suits, but it's no longer designed to go out and fly off and become a self-contained space capsule. You know, and then, you know, with today's robotics and all, they'll go out and they'll grab you satellites if they need to. Of course, now the program's canceled, but space station-wise, if they don't need it, that's all been dropped. Let me see, as far as what else, recharge, let me drop. They didn't say if they recharged the whole tank, you know, whatever it was. He needed a couple more hours, so they took care of that. Whether or not they gave him a full blast or not, who knows. One tank was, like what I was saying, around 3,000. Then there was another reserve tank. I believe I read a couple of days ago, I think it was 6,500 pounds. It was a lot higher than I thought. So that kind of surprised me. Because, you know, like when you buy these big oxygen tanks and you use them for cutting steel, whatever, or welding, they come in around 3,200 pounds, 33. That's good. Here they are up and out of space, and they have a reserve tank at 6,000. That kind of surprised me. But back to you, Dick.
AWZ, listening.
AWZ, recognized. We're going to get you in a second. I think it's W-A-2-A-W-Z. The maximum pressure you can put into a tank, Paul, is a strong function of what is the diameter of the tank. And so if the tank is a smaller diameter, a skinny, long tank, you can run at a much higher pressure. So I'm going to guess that the reserve tank for safety is a smaller diameter, higher pressure, a smaller period of time. Like I think it's only good for something like 1 hour, whereas the main tank, which is much larger at a lower pressure, is good for something like 6 hours. That's what I think is going on. Is that the... Is the smaller high pressure is the high pressure tank much smaller in diameter of Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, the you're right. It's a bigger tank, and that's an SB suit, and then they attached it a PPRP, I think they call it. What does that stand for? Personal, I don't know, portable life supply, whatever that. This thing attaches to the outside of the regular tank, you know, the regular backpack, and in that they have the supply tank, and they're smaller. They did say that they are smaller. So, you know, and then naturally for a shorter period of time, but I think with the, you know, the extra reserves, that gives them an hour or two of, you know, emergency supply if they needed it. That's what's going on there. But interesting, the EVAs, and then there's other numbers that came up. They said the International Space Station, they're running at 8 pounds. I was kind of surprised to hear that. That allows them to have a shorter, you know, they don't want to get the bend, so a shorter time to breathe oxygen instead of a longer period of time. They don't have to go down to the lower pressure. The EVAs on the space shuttle, the spacesuits had 4.8. I said 5. It's a little bit less than 5 pounds. 4.8 or something. The other numbers we talked about were okay. 14.7 pounds for the International Space Station. 10 pounds for the airlock area in the Quest, and the airlock area in the space shuttle. You know, that was all right. We had that right. So,
like you do.
Very fine, Paul. Mr. AWZ, give me your full call and your name, sir, and go ahead with your comment. K2RIW.
K2RIW, this is Kilo David 2, Alpha Whiskey Victor. Name here is Greg. I just wanted to step in for a moment if I could. How are you receiving me? I'm near the JFK airport area, and I'm pushing in 440 repeater, rooftop antenna, 5-watt blocker.
You're getting through very nicely. Do you have any comments to what's going on here? Go ahead.
Negative. I was just got the system together for tonight, and I just wanted to see if I was putting out. I heard you guys on the radio on all three repeaters, and I figured I'd just see if I could get out to you with this little play here. Other than that, thank you very much, and back to you, I think, John.
Yeah, my name is Greg. There we go. Here we go. You're Greg. My name is Dick, and the other guy is John. And the man who was just sitting before me was Paul. He's our space expert. Alrighty. Hey, you're doing a good job from that distance into the 440 input. Let's see, we don't have... let me do a quick check. Oh, we do have an input on 2.5 right now. Alrighty. Let's make another attempt with West. N2XJN. K2RIW.
Stick.
I say that again, John?
Quick comment. I emailed you an article.
U.S. So I have one question.
Maybe we spoke about it. I don't believe so. But Fermilab, it was a Scientific American article, I think last week sometime, I emailed you. Fermilab, in their research on this problem with the speed of the neutrinos, they also stumbled across another sheet they have to examine because they think they have detected the Higgs boson. What did we spend all that money for that Rank Collider for?
Well, we still have to do it because Fermi had been looking for a long time. It didn't look like Fermi was going to find it. I am guessing that since CERN pinned down the approximate area where it is, you know, what energy level, so to speak, then Fermilab could go back, look at that data more carefully and say, oh yeah, I do see a little blip there, a blip there. And on top of that, I think there's a lot more things that CERN's going to be doing. But yes, it's a very expensive experiment, but it's not on our soil. We didn't have to fund the whole thing. Paul, I know you had another question or comment, so go right ahead. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, and the other machine dropped, so I'm back on the Western input.
Almost in parallel, sometimes letting him come to a point at the ends, and then feeding it in the middle with reference to ground, with a another political assembly of wire or wires. That was just a popular antenna at the time. You're about to ask, do they really gain very much by running four wires in parallel as opposed to one? I think the answer is no. I think the gain was very little, but here I'm not sure. And it was just a popular concept at the time for building an antenna. These are spark gap transmitters, and the spark gap transmitter is not easy to say what frequency it's on. It's on almost all frequencies at once. And I think the Titanic was a reasonably large powered transmitter, and I believe that at the very end, the Carpathia was listening to Titanic, and the guy in Titanic was sending a series of Vs, and he was very weak. I think what was happening is his voltage was decreasing because the power supply was going underwater in the ship, in the engine room, and he was resetting the spark gap because he had lower voltage to work with. He was resetting the spark gap, and pretty soon he couldn't set any spark at all, and he could no longer make any transmissions. That's what I think was going on, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. I thought maybe it was a redundant system, you know, in case one wire broke, they had the other one up. I saw the four wires, and the article, I read the whole article, and they didn't refer to, you know, to that. Very good, Dick. I was going to ask this a week or two ago, but you know what happens. Back to you, Dick.
Bear in mind, Paul, that I'm giving you my speculation. I'm not absolutely positive on this. Everything I know about antennas tells me that one wire would give them 95% of the performance, so to speak. I don't think the other four gained very much. It added a little bit of extra capacitance, so it's a little bit more of a top hat. But that could have easily been tuned by a loading coil at the bottom at the transmitter, I think. And so I am guessing that spark gap transmitter had a butt plate on the ship somewhere that picked up ground, and the spark gap transmitter was sort of a fourth spark coil almost. Between it and that vertical wire that went up to a vertical wires, then it went up to that great big horizontal thing of four wires. So, did you pick up that? I should take a good look at it. When it comes to the picture of that antenna, did you get that out of QST magazine or from some other article there? WS2N, K2RIW?
That I was from QST. I looked through another magazine. I couldn't find, you know, I couldn't see that. Time magazine has a whole magazine dedicated to that one topic of the Titanic, but they didn't have any pictures of the antenna, so I didn't find it.
This month we're coming up to, I think it was April 12th. I'm not positive of the date now. It was 1912. What was the date in 1912 in April that the Titanic went down? Do you know, Paul?
The 14th, and then hit the berg on the 14th and actually sank on the 15th.
Yeah, I think it sank within, something like 2.5 hours or 3 hours from the time it hit the berg. And the way it was explained in one of the movies I saw is that the declaration that the Titanic was unsinkable was not a declaration of the shipbuilder or the line owner. It was a declaration by the news media. The news media declared it to be unsinkable, but the shipbuilder didn't claim that. But the individual compartments, if I understand correctly, didn't have a cover on the top of the compartments, so that when the ship sinks far enough, when the bow sinks far enough, water is able to flow over one partition of a compartment into the next, because there were no top hats on the compartments. Is that about the way you see it, Paul? Had the compartments been thoroughly sealed, I think the ship would have survived. WS2N, K2RIW?
I've seen a lot of shows on it. I've really never seen that, you know, that the water got in over the top of it, of each, you know. I mean, if they're going to seal it, you'd think they would have sealed it all the way, but I don't know. The latest one I heard is this gash was a couple hundred feet long, you know, so took out at least three compartments. I think, you know, that would have That would have done them in. You know, maybe if you hit one compartment, I think maybe they would have been okay. But I think it ran the length of a long, long.